Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is episode number 9 for January 2009. Michael Dell needs more bodyguards. Hello and welcome to the Phileas Club, the show where we talk about international news and world news from around the world. And by from around the world, I mean that we have guests from all around the world. I'm Patrick Beja, your host, and today I welcome, of course, again, the one, the myth, the legend, Turkey from Saudi Arabia. How are you, Turkey?
Yes, that's me.
The cheering you're hearing is from another returning guest from last month, Randy, who is now situated in Canada, if I'm not mistaken. How are you, Randy?
I'm in Vancouver. I'm doing very well. And the cheering you were hearing was from the tumultuous crowd that comes to listen to the live recording of the Phileas Club. That was.
Are you freezing well up there?
It is cold. I wouldn't say it is obnoxiously cold, but it is not. It's nothing like, say, Mexico City or where you are, Turkey.
What?
We're near the freezing.
Turkey is
point.
In Mexico City.
I said or. Or where Turkey Turkey is.
I thought I learned something about Turkey's life. The last person on the call today is patiently waiting to be introduced. It's Mohammed, who is also actually a returning host from, that was a while ago, Mohammed, wasn't it?
It was episode 3.
Episode 3, wow, okay. So you're the kid of the team. You're 16.
Thank you. My reputation goes down instantly.
No, I mean that as a compliment. I mean that as a compliment because, you know, we're old farts and you're the young kid, you know, who knows what the kids do these days.
Are you calling me an old fart?
Yes, I am.
That's exactly what he did.
Just was making sure.
Okay, good. So, Mohammed, you're in Qatar at the moment, and that's your actual place of residence.
Yes, it's my home country.
Is it cold in Qatar? Okay, that's silly. Don't answer that.
Actually, it is.
Really? How cold?
Yeah, bring a sweater cold. It gets down to, I think, 15 degrees Celsius or below.
Oh, geez.
At the night, it's very cold.
That's cold for you?
Thank you for
what's
the weather.
Cold for you?
Well,
Petra?
it's 2 degrees Celsius in Paris now. Randy, can you translate that in Fahrenheit instantly?
That's around 36 Fahrenheit, and it's about the same here in Vancouver.
Oh, jeez.
I don't understand Fahrenheit Celsius.
I don't either. Don't ask.
You should just make more.
No one in the world understands imperial measurements, except maybe a few people in England.
Isn't Celsius so much easier? You know, 0 degrees water freezes, 100 degrees water boils at sea level. That's it. That's all you need to know.
You don't know Americans. The Americans are just stubborn. They just love to do what they want to do.
Oh,
they ignore everybody else.
Okay, you know what? Let's keep moving.
I'm enjoying slamming Americans. Why are we moving on?
Well, because if we start this, the introduction is never going to end. So let's just end the introduction and start the actual show so you can slam everyone you want and we will enjoy it, I'm sure. By the way, I'm done with the music transitions between the different parts of the show, because I'm lazy and editing is boring. So this show is going to be the first one where we just transition like this from the introduction to the international news section, where I think the first topic is going to be Gaza. So as most of you know, I'm sure, the war in Gaza has come to an end a few weeks ago, and Hamas and Israel have agreed on a ceasefire. And I think we've talked about the war quite a bit in the past few months. But what I wanted to do today was talk about the perception of the war, and if it started as, I guess some people thought it was almost, would agree with Israel that it was self-defense. I felt that in the past, in the last few weeks of the offensive, it was sliding towards a, let's call it a PR disaster, and people were starting to think, wow, this is like Lebanon, and it's a bad. Even the supporters of Israel were calling for it to stop. So that was my feeling, and maybe a little bit of the feeling in France. And let's keep in mind that France is usually, I think it's safe to say, pro-Palestinian in general. So it was probably a good time to stop and agree on the ceasefire. I know it's very cold to say this, but from a PR standpoint. Guys, what did you think? Did it slide like this in your countries? I'm going to start with the easy one, Turkey. How did the truce go in Saudi Arabia?
Well, the fact is, it really depends on who you're talking about. So in Saudi Arabia, there's two people. There are people who are highly educated, moderate to liberal, and most of these people would only talk in private on these matters, and they would say Hamas was asking for it, it's about time Israel did something about it. And although they are happy about the peace because Israel did overdo it.
Okay.
And however, for the general public, the majority and the things that you hear in public, which is that was a massacre, it was a Holocaust, and Israel should be punished for it immediately.
Okay. So, side question, what would happen? I know it's become sort of a ritual when we talk with you, Turkey, because it's very surprising for most of us. But I always ask the question, what would happen if someone talked about this in public? What would happen to him?
If you mean the ones that would show support to Israel?
Yeah, well, maybe not show support, but at least, you know, make an educated educated analysis of the situation.
A very simple thing. They would be declared a traitor, an outcast, an anti-Islamic, and a Jew lover.
Okay. Does that have legal ramifications or just social suicide?
No, it's mostly social, but it also could harm you physically. Not okay. By the government, by the people. So.
I see. Mohammed, what's the situation in Qatar?
Well, during Qatar, our only since we have Al Jazeera, we host Al Jazeera in Qatar. Yeah. We have been the same stands as Al Jazeera. For example, when we had the Arab summit January 16th, Qatar and Mauritania, they cut off economic and political ties with Israel over protest on the Gaza dispute. So basically, Qatar really wanted it to end, just like everyone else, because we want political advances in this situation. We don't want 1,000 people to die on both sides.
So does that mean that, you know, cut off economical ties with Israel, does that mean that they are absolutely siding with Hamas on every issue, and or do they also engage in maybe, you know, talks and on the street? Would they understand the situation the way that Turkey was talking about some people in Saudi Arabia?
Well, in Qatar we have for example, when we say economic ties being cut off, that means trade being cut off, for example, sure. The oil, the gas, and all that, all the way to Israel. If it goes to Israel, we can't send it. But over here, as a voice, we Qataris are only 10% of Qatar. 90% of Qatar is expatriates. I don't know, maybe that percentage changed or increased, but if you... The voices here are mostly international, so we can't take a strong side.
I see. Is that expatriates from the Western world or from the Middle East?
From all over. We have French communities, Danish communities, English communities, Filipino community. We have many different communities here, so they live here, but they don't really have a voice in the say of what Qatar does, but if you ask them on the street, they have their own opinions.
I see. Hey, again, a side question. Turkey, how is Qatar perceived in the Arab world? I mean, it seems to be a very specific kind of country with very open with Al Jazeera and a huge Western community. Is it perceived as a real, quote-unquote, Arab country, or is it like the apart from the pack and sort of strange cousin?
Qatar is actually seen by most Arab countries, and basically mostly by Saudi Arabia and by Egypt, these two countries specifically, as a small piece of land with people who are trying to create this empire by putting themselves in the middle of every conflict and trying to sound like they're the good people and they're the ones who are trying to fix things and so on. And Al Jazeera is not even helping that reputation, as Al Jazeera is never, ever a type of news channel, at least not the Arabic. The English one, I think, is a very good news channel. It is. It does bring the truth. However, Al Jazeera Arabic always has an agenda that is trying to promote.
Okay. I'm going to return the question to Mohammed. How do you perceive the rest of the Arab world? And by you, I mean, Qatar in general.
Well, Arab world is in closest areas or in general, such as Jordan, Turkey?
In general. The Arab / Islamic world.
Okay, if you're going to talk about closest people such as Dubai, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, it's sort of how I see it. Like, I see it as good friends. Like, you see each other in the different countries, you just give a nod because you know they're both from Arab countries, and you have a sort of connection with them. So it's pretty good. With the farther away Arab countries, we have some people here who perceive them as non-Arabs. Like, some people's mentality here. They see, for example, if someone from Jordan comes, they treat them such as a foreigner.
Oh, wow. So is there like a divide, because you were talking about Dubai, is there a divide between like the rich Arab countries and the poor Arab countries?
It's not about rich or poor. It's about where he's from. For example, how can I explain? It's such as if we have a person from Jordan coming in, he'll be the exact same treatment as if an English guy comes in or an American guy comes in. But if there's someone from Bahrain or Dubai or Emirates, comes in, there's sort of a brotherly feeling. Like, they're closer together, so they know each other.
I see. Okay, we veered away a little bit from Gaza here. Let's get back to the perception of the war. With Randy in the U.S. and maybe even Canada, since you're in Canada at the moment.
I think my favorite perception of the ceasefire is that it happened. I mean, it literally started at midnight on January 21st. Mm-hmm. For Israel, that was only 2 hours after President Obama was sworn in.
Okay.
And it was just very, very strange. That day was the day that every single media company in the world that had any news element whatsoever was only talking about this one thing, and it was and you kept hearing these replays like 2 hours ago President Obama took the oath of office, becoming the you know, the president of the United States and Israel and Palestinians are now getting along. You know, like those were related occurrences. It was very strange.
But, so the Obama effect was perceivable in that too.
Exactly, and of course the point to be made there is
I'm sorry, Randy. Just to make things clear, are you actually saying that by some magical thing, the two events were perceived as being related, actually, or were you making a joke? A joke.
They were definitely reported as being related. I don't know.
They are related.
Well, okay, and I tend to agree with that. I do think that when it came time to pick a time, all right, here is when we stop military operations. The beginning of the Obama administration was something that came to mind for those Israeli leaders. But I doubt that they said, I would really like to go watch the inauguration, so let's have a ceasefire.
No, it's more about that the Obama legacy would be different, and they figured, let's start fresh with this new president. Let's not put him in trouble as soon as he gets become president. He wouldn't end up liking us so much.
Hmm. Well, and I agree with Turkey.
To his credit, he didn't send George Mitchell to Jerusalem immediately. He waited a few days and let the situation, and I'm not saying that President Obama is going to micromanage a situation, but I thought it was very cool the way the new president let people who were on the scene take care of their business. He had business at home to sure. immediately deal with. And then after a week passed, he asked the United States Middle Eastern envoy, George Mitchell, to go meet with everyone. And, of course, they all received him. He met with Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah. And he did that first, I think, is the way the way it was reported, which was very, I think, was a little bit symbolic.
And about the degree – oh, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I can't get over the sense from in the news that the United States is still doing what it always does, which is to say, it's in the middle of everything, but trying to carry an air of a little higher wisdom and a little more gravitas than previously.
Okay. And yeah, so about the degrading of the image of the war, if there is such a thing, do you feel like it was also turning into a Lebanon disaster number two, or
Feel like it was reported that way in North America.
Okay,
it was reported in North America as this great big horrible thing, and it was particularly horrible because in North America you had Christmas and New Year's holidays, so there were a lot of people who were on vacation and trying to relax and had a lot of time to turn on the news and see what was going on.
So it was more of an inconvenience to the people who were vacationing.
I don't mean to say that, but if you were trying to, I'm trying to draw a distinction with.
Actually, also you have the fact that most of the Christian holidays are highly celebrated in Palestine. So that would affect the celebrations there. So it kind of affects the most of the Christian population around the world.
Right. Okay. And of course, every news service loves to send a small crew to Jerusalem and Bethlehem and so forth to take some live pictures that they can show on Christmas Eve and this sort of thing. And when there's a major military operation going on, that kind of dominates the imagery.
Sure.
So nonetheless, the answer to your question is I do not believe that this month of war was as bad for the popular opinion as the Lebanese operations were.
Sure. Yeah, I don't mean to say that it was as bad. I just mean that it was starting to, you know, turn into something that could have become as bad. So it was probably a good idea to stop now. I know it's horrible to speak about this in PR terms, but
Oh no, that's exactly what this is. An ongoing conflict is a PR war.
Sure.
If suddenly a conflict arose in South America between Brazil and Ecuador, you would not worry much about the PR aspects of it, because you would be trying to understand and trying to let the world know why there was this sudden war going on and what the facts about the situation were, and trying to determine who is doing what for what.
Yeah.
Whereas that's so long established in Israel that you can effectively say everyone knows why this warring is going on. Let's talk about something as complicated and seemingly unrelated as what people think in Florida. And that, I mean, quite frankly, as I said the last time on the Phileas Club, ever since major changes in the Middle East in the early 90s, we've seen the PR battle going to a solid victory for the Palestinians. The Palestinians have captured the hearts of all of the left in North America. Mostly on the underdog syndrome, which is a valid way to get people interested in your success.
I would have to agree. All right, we talked about Obama a little bit, so let's go transition to that, because of course, as everyone knows, I don't think anyone can ignore that, cannot know that. He was sworn in a couple of weeks ago, 10 days ago, was it?
Wow, really?
Well, yeah, it's that little thing. And by the way, there was a huge blunder at the swearing-in itself, because it appeared to be a mistake on Obama's part when it was actually a mistake on Chief Justice Roberts' part. Who, by the way, is a stark enemy of Obama politically. He inverted two words, so Obama, when he was going to repeat it, realized that the words were inverted, so he paused to give him the opportunity to correct himself. Anyway, that was what happened, and what I'd like to know is as how people talked about it, because I thought it was huge. And in France, we looked at it as, something endearing and sort of like of cute. And, it was a huge amount of pressure. Haha, it was a slight mistake. It's not going to have big consequences. And that's it. But I can imagine that if someone had, wanted to cast a negative light on Obama, he could exploit that mistake in a very effective way. So again, and first of all, Turkey, you lose your bet. He got sworn in, so pay up. I don't know what we did.
Hey, my bet was that he might not make it to the inauguration. However, if he does make it, I give him 1 year. That was my bet. So until he finishes 1 year, then you can say you won.
Okay.
This is going to go on forever, you know.
Yeah,
we're going to be talking to Turkey for the next 50 years about how...
No.
How
it's 1 year.
Not only
I have an image to protect. I am the Dvorak of this show, and I have to protect that image.
I don't buy it. So you mean what happens in 1 year if he's still in office and he's still alive? Are you going to all invite us to Saudi Arabia and, I don't know, invite us to the restaurant or something?
Sure, you can just pay the ticket and I'll take care of the restaurant.
Okay, that's a deal. All right, so the mistake at the swearing in, what of it?
No big deal.
Okay.
Yeah, it was no big deal. Even if he didn't do the oath, it's by law and constitution that he's president by noon.
Okay.
Even without the oath. So it was just, he was under pressure, so there's really isn't that much to talk about.
Well, I'm sure that some people, and by some people I mean Fox News, might have a different take on it. So I'm turning to Randy now.
There were a handful of crackpot reports for about 48 hours after the swearing in. Just a very small number of reports that that there, you know, there was a rumor that someone somewhere was going to enter a case into a court, suing the government for some mistake that was always very ill-defined and so forth.
Okay.
But I was in a crowd of people during the inauguration. I was in a movie theater watching it, and there was an audible gasp around the room because other than see, we had all just sat through a 6 or 7 hour long sermon that was called a prayer, and I was blown away by how long that preacher stood and prayed before we finally got to see Obama sworn in. So a lot of people had almost fallen asleep.
I think they were trying to establish that he wasn't a secret Muslim, but
I think they were. I think you're absolutely right. They were trying to establish that all of his atheism, all of his Islam, and all of his Scientology are going to take a back seat. But I mean, seriously, it was really much later than most of us expected in that theater. We had all shown up. You know, a lot of people got there just a few minutes before the vice president was sworn in and kind of expected things to move right along. And then other than that prayer, they really did. There were no mistakes. You know, they had music and poetry and so forth, and there were no mistakes except this one big glaring error, which was entirely John Roberts' fault. And quite frankly, that's not even fair. Both of those men know that oath. Every school child in the United States learns that oath because it's an interesting, very short oath of office. President Obama used to teach constitutional political science. He knows it, of course.
Well, hey, and Chief Justice Roberts, of course, he knows it too. So I guess we can put it on, you know, it was emotional.
Yeah, and it was just one of those things. I don't think there was some malicious intent by John Roberts. If he really wanted to screw up President Obama in front of the entire world, he would have done a much better job. So,
I don't know. That was a pretty good job. I mean, I don't know what else he could have done. He could have, I don't know, pushed him so that he fell on his ass or something like that. But, I don't know.
Slapped him.
Yeah, exactly.
Just one of those things. And my only fault that I want to find is that Obama didn't just say the oath correctly, that he insisted on trying to follow what Roberts was feeding him.
Yeah, he tried to give him a chance to say it well, to say it correctly.
And I would have preferred, if it were me, if I had just been elected president of the United States, I would have just said the oath the way I know it is supposed to be said.
And embarrassed the guy.
Right. That would have made the Chief Justice look so stupid.
And this is probably how we know that Obama is a better politician than you are.
I promise you Obama's a better politician than I am.
Another thing that I want to talk about, a little bit more substance here, is the first decision that is highly symbolic of Obama, which was to suspend the legal proceedings in Guantanamo for 120 days. That was his first official act as president, if I'm not mistaken. And so, of course, again, that has a huge signification in the world. But even more probably in the Muslim world. So once again, we're very, you know, regular, orderly today. I think that's the word I'm looking for. I'm going through every person one after the other. It's very nice. We're like in a row. It's good. So Guantanamo closed, or at least the process has begun. Turkey, what do you think?
Well, the biggest news, in my opinion, about the whole Obama thing is the fact that his first interview as the president of the United States was done for an Arabic news network.
In Qatar.
So without considering whatever the Guantanamo and all of that stuff, he said one thing, and that's the one thing I'm going to say. Himself, he said it. He said, don't trust me on my words, trust me on my acts. So I'll just wait and see what he does.
Does that reflect the feelings of the Saudis in general?
Arabs in general.
Okay. Do you confirm that, Mohammed?
Confirm the idea of Obama being what?
No, the fact that the Arab world is waiting on Obama's action to judge him, and they're not either. You know, they're not adverse to him or pro Obama until he actually does stuff.
Yeah, the Arab world, they're not really sure. The Arab world is happy that Bush is gone, but right now we're trying to see what Obama's going to do to us, because now we're just looking for someone else to take control of the mess.
You know, I have to say that even in France, the Obama euphoria is sort of dying down a little bit, and people are starting to say, okay, fine, okay, that's it. He's president now. And now let's actually see what he does and what he does when he gets to work. So maybe that's larger than just the Arab world. Although I would have to say that the big thing about Obama getting elected was the fact that he got elected in the first place. That's why all the euphoria is really happening. It's not only because he's replacing Bush, but that's on a side note. Randy, closing of Guantanamo.
I think very highly reported in North America, fairly well received. You have to remember that Obama does have a long way to go to bring the political opposition closer to him in the United States, and in particular in the countries neighboring the United States. And I think he is doing that. And I like that the reporting has not been very simple. Obama closed Guantanamo Bay, and there was much celebration. The reporting has been about how that's a complicated move. It's going to take a while. You know, it said to me that right out of the gate, if there's one thing that the Obama administration has that's working very well, it's a press team. I was really impressed with how much of their message they got out through the media immediately. Mm. Now, his opposition is going to say, well, that's because the media wants to portray him as succeeding. I don't know if that is a case that really holds water.
They wouldn't want to portray him as not succeeding, I guess.
I think in North America, the media is ready to eat. They're like a starving dog that is ready to eat a bit of food that has fallen off the table. They're not going to treat anyone, you know, Obama or anyone else, with some special reverence if they have the opportunity to portray him as messing up.
So do you mean that the press has woken up? They're thinking, okay, we can do our job now because of Obama's, you know, okay, I'm going to be a little bit partisan here, but I think it's safe to say that the Bush administration was not the best people to work with on the press side. The redactment and the denying of certain stories and things like that. It wasn't easy, and it sort of put the press in an awkward position. Although, of course, they are at fault too, but. Did the situation change the day the administration changed?
I don't think so. But I think there's been a long change coming, and it started from before the election. There was a sort of peak of press nonsense, and it was really just before the official debates between the two candidates that you started seeing these interviews where these press talking heads appeared to be fawning over Barack Obama and just literally begging him on the air to do whatever he had to do to win because they wanted him to win. And there was a lot of backlash for that. And I think in a lot of newsrooms in North America, the people who really run the show came out and said, okay, stop it. We have a job to do. Get it straight. We don't know who's going to win, you know. Yeah. No one does, and we need to start being reporters again. And the high came down. There was another spike at the actual election when a lot of the press were, you know, elated like everyone else, and then it started coming down again. And I really do get the perception that we're back to there are left-wing newsrooms and right-wing newsrooms and a lot of newsrooms that are just trying to do news in the middle, and they're all doing what we expect them to do now.
So the press is back. For whatever reason, whatever process, it's back in action.
I think so, and my example of that is that Obama wasn't just given a free pass to say, I'm closing Guantanamo Bay, here you go. Mm. And we didn't get the usual standard stuff where, you know, the left-wing press says, this is great, all is well, and the right-wing press says, this is horrible. No, we actually got what I thought was a pretty complex and careful assessment of what that was going to entail. It's going to take an entire year to completely close that facility and to completely disperse all of the different individuals that are a part of that facility on both sides of the fence, and that was not reported in this partisan way. I thought it was very balanced.
Well, hey, what do you know? Maybe he can actually make miracles if he fixed the press.
It looks like a miracle. It only looks like a miracle because I my opinion is he's come in with a press team that knows what to do, as opposed to the previous administration.
I'm joking, of course. I mean, if the press is actually getting back on track, it's obviously a good thing for everyone.
The press won't be on track, trust me. It's just this: they had this long vacation of supporting Obama because he was the big news. Everybody wanted to know about him. Now, as soon as Obama finishes at least for his first 100 days, then the press is going to start attacking him.
You think so?
I'm sure of it. It's politics. They need to sell.
I agree.
People to watch the news. They need them to sell newspapers or whatever.
I agree. And I will take a press that will attack an administration any day over a press that will roll over for an administration, whatever the administration. So if you think that they're going to start getting angry again, that's fine by me. What's not angry but rather depressed is the Davos World Economic Forum. So that's going to be our last topic, international topic, I think, for the day. And I don't even think there's much to say about it because we all know what's been happening economically in the world. But the only thing I want to say is that the World Economic Forum has been seen as a place of arrogance for many, many years, and, well, arrogance in a way, but, you know, the world leaders coming together and being on top of the world as they were. And this year, with everything that's been happening, it seems that they are very, I would venture to say, afraid. Like, they are very humble and timid, even. Or at least that's the way we've been hearing about it. It's very surprising for the forum to be portrayed that way, where, you know, all the power in the world is together for a short period of time. Did you guys have anything to add about this? Or,
well, there wasn't any real news from that whole thing, except the whole thing about the Prime Minister of Turkey leaving abruptly, being pissed off at the president of Israel.
I didn't follow enough news, but I didn't hear about this.
You didn't hear about this? That's the only big news that came out of that whole thing.
Well, you know, we've had a huge storm in Paris, in France, that I will get to a little bit later, maybe, but that was pretty much the only thing on the news for the past week. But can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Basically, they were talking, and there was the Secretary General of the Arab League, the Prime Minister of Turkey, and the President of Israel. I'm not sure who else was there. And apparently, they gave the President of Israel too much more time than the whole forum allowed. And they didn't give the other people enough time, and the Prime Minister of Turkey got so pissed off, and his only word was, yeah, you Israelis know very well how to kill children, and he just stormed out of there, pissed off that nobody would allow him to speak. And he went back to Turkey and was greeted as a hero.
Okay. That's pretty big. I must have missed it because it's not possible that that wasn't reported on here. Guys, anything else about Davos?
I think the only thing that I got out of that was the way Putin put it. He explained it as the perfect storm, and the way he explained it, it really made sense that we should look at this economic problem and actually work together, stop being, you know, wasting our money, and actually come together as all the world leaders and actually try to fix it. The way he said it, I don't know.
It was impressive.
Yeah, it was impressive from the way he said it.
Randy?
Sort of the same thing. Okay. I did not. it's sort of the same thing. I'm just having a hard time getting my words out. I would say that the conference was underreported in North America.
Ah, thank you. I'm not the only one who feels that way.
No, there's no doubt it was. In fact, only the Turkish PM walking out really rose to the level of reporting that I kind of assumed the entire event would receive.
Mm.
I'm surprised you missed that, but then again, as we've learned on the Phileas Club, what is perceived as the most important fact of any particular subject varies widely from one region of the world to another.
Sure. Well, I'm sure it was pretty important here too, but the fact that this storm was so huge, probably, you know, the storm and, by the way, the strikes that I'm going to get to in a minute also.
So there's one more thing from Davos. And okay. This is more fun, and just to show you what that person Putin is. This is technology headline.
Oh, currently, are you going to talk about Putin and Michael Dell?
Yeah, exactly. That's the one.
Go ahead.
So what does Dell goes to Putin and tells him, how can we help you with your country's IT infrastructure? And Putin immediately looks at the guy and says, we don't need your help. We are not invalids. We don't have limited mental capacity.
Wow.
That's, you know, and Putin is a guy that you don't want to piss off. I think Michael Dell should hire a couple of bodyguards, extra bodyguards now.
I have an opinion on this, and it really bothered me. And I'm not about to say what I'm about to say because I happen to... I happen to call my place of residence Round Rock, Texas, which is the home of Dell Computer. I really don't have any particular love for Michael Dell or Dell Computer in general. But you have to see, I have called for on previous podcasts for Russia to be kicked off the internet. They are one of the three worst of breed countries on the internet today, and they have been for a long time. Basically, you know, Russia became independent of the USSR about the same time the internet came into being and went worldwide. And they have always, for that entire time, they have been a collection of bad citizens on the internet. And so I don't understand.
Can you be more specific about this? Like, you mean the spam and the filtering and stuff like that, or what do you mean?
Exactly. That's exactly what I mean. There is a Wild West lack of control in certain countries, and Russia is a prime example of being unwilling or uncaring about how your IP. Your IPs are used. That's Russia.
So
and everyone. I mean, I always wonder: does Russia know that the rest of the world perceives them as the source of all pedophilia, of all hacker IPs? You know, that sort of thing. And that's what I wanted to get to. What Vladimir Putin did was he essentially made a hypocrite of himself because he said we're not a bunch of idiots. We know about technology, and the fact is they clearly don't. The rest of the world knows that they clearly don't know what's going on in their IP space.
You know, I'll say two things about this. First of all, I think you, Randy, are going to need bodyguards also. because you pissed off Putin. And second, I would say I think it's more of a cultural misunderstanding that happened there. The way I see it is, Michael Dell was going at this with a commercial mindset. He was saying, like a car salesman, he was saying, "So what do I need to do to get you with that car today? Like, what do I need to do to get you to buy my computers? How can I help you make your infrastructure better?" You know, this mindset that of the salesman. And Putin took it as, what the hell are you saying? Do you mean I can't take care of things myself and Russians are idiots? I think that's what's happened there. And maybe there was something lost in the translation or something like that, but
there was.
I'm sure it
they
was
were
a misunderstanding.
Definitely, but. I agree. They were definitely talking past one another. You know, the big Dell quote is, "How can we help?" That's what we heard on the news. Sure. Michael Dell, we actually heard Michael Dell's voice saying, "How can we help?" Mm. And I think that was misinterpreted by the Russians. I really do. And quite frankly, that's whenever you're misinterpreted, it's always your own fault, you know? And Michael Dell probably should have been.
Well, and Michael Dell is also an American, and Russians don't love Americans so much.
That might have something to do with it, yeah. All right, let's move on to the local stories. By the way, last thing, Iraq voted today, and apparently it's going very well. So, yay, Iraq. Right?
Yay!
Okay, cool. Local stories. I'm going to start here because I have actually a serious story about the strikes in France. For once, because I keep going on about the French people who like strikes, and we have strikes all the time, and blah blah blah. And it's true, and we always do have strikes, but this one is pretty major, and so I think it's worth spending a little bit of time on it. So I'll just talk alone for 2 minutes, and then you tell me what you thought. So the strikes was really big. We had about between 1 and 2.5 million people demonstrating in the streets. Of course, it was, you know, the workers demonstrating because the situation is not good, quote unquote. I'm saying between 1 and 2.5 million because that's the estimates of the police on one side and of the organizers of the strikes on the other. And in France, to give you a scale, we have about 70 million people living in the country. That was probably the biggest strike in a very long time. But, you know, we have huge strikes every 5 or 10 years. That was probably the biggest one for 10 or 20 years. And the thing that struck me the most was that there wasn't one unified reason for people to go on strike. It was really, when you would ask people, the journalists would ask people on the street, "So why are you on strike today?" They would say, you know, "Well, because we don't have enough money to buy stuff. And, you know, it's the government isn't good and they're not taking the right decisions. And the we're unhappy." That was the general feeling, which was a little bit strange because I would think that if there was so much, you know, discontent in the population, there would be very specific reasons that you could name. But what was really interesting was that both the private and the public sectors were involved in that strike. And usually the public sectors goes on strike easily because they have job security, and the private sector is, you know, a little bit less inclined. But even though it was less represented, it was still there. And what was, interesting to me was that in this country, the private sector considered that the government was responsible for the layoffs and the bad economy. So and they wanted the government to go more social, so they would pin the economic crisis on the government, which is, of course, arguable. I'm not saying that it's not the case. I'm just saying it might not be seen the same as like that in other countries. And finally, the general feeling was that the when things go well, the corporations and the big companies give money to the stockholders, and when things go bad, they will take money from, you know, the taxpayers' money. So I would have a couple of extra things to say about this. The fact that the government insisted on lending money to the banks, that the banks that would take the money would not get give bonuses to their leaders, which seems very sensible to most people. And the banks would not agree at first, but their hand got forced. And but then the opposition, the political opposition, was again very unhappy about the way things were going. And to give you an idea of how people perceive that situation, the opposition would suggest that not only the companies and the banks that would get the money would not give bonuses to their leaders, obviously, but also that the government would have people from the government to sit on the boards of those banks and those companies to take part in the decisions. So again, I thought that would be interesting to show you how to the left France generally is on the things they want to do to combat the economic crisis. So that was my little spiel to explain about the strikes in France. I would like to know now how you guys perceived them and if you even reported on them. Again, strikes. Turkey, go ahead.
You had strikes.
Okay. Wow. I would have expected for you to at least hear about them. It was really huge.
I honestly haven't heard a single thing about it.
Okay, wow. You know, it's also interesting because usually France is at the forefront of the social unrest
in Europe. I think we were too busy with Obama and Gaza.
Okay. That part was completely eclipsed by the strikes and the storm. Mohammed?
About the strikes, I haven't really heard much about it in the news. There was in Al Jazeera when I watched it, there was a couple minutes about it. They talked a little about it and left it.
Okay.
What I had to do to find it was just go on the internet and actually read about it. And, you know, when you read it from the internet, it's the same. I read it from Yahoo News, so it's the same thing that probably Randy's going to say. So.
Well, let's ask Randy.
Very much low coverage for France in the last couple of weeks. I was surprised by that. There was a bit of coverage about the storms, and practically nothing about political machinations in France the last couple of weeks. And by practically nothing, I really mean that. I know there are people around me who are real media junkies and read everything. They use Google News to read, three or four dozen stories a day. But you have to really look hard to find any analysis in North America of the subjects you were just talking about.
Wow, I really thought that you would have heard about this. It's huge here, really huge. So I'm a little bit disappointed.
I am too.
We're used to it. You always strike, so it's not a big deal anymore.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. I mean, we always strike, but this one is different. It's really, and as I was saying, France is usually at the forefront of social, action. And so it might spread to other countries, very possibly.
We'll see. I always thought Michael Dell was at the forefront of social change. So. I don't know.
Well, that too. So the other thing, of course, was the big storm, which it was surprising because some people Twittered about this and Twittered to me specifically asking how we were doing. And even though, it was a huge storm, but it wasn't like a Katrina-like hurricane. So there was 9 dead, I think, but the most of the damage was infrastructure damage. So there was a million and a half people that didn't have electricity in the southwest of France, but that lasted for about a week, and now there's only less than 100,000 people that still don't have electricity. And there was something new about this, though, in the French media. You always have, people showing internet videos on TV as news reporting of sorts, as part of the news reporting. On this one, because of the nature of the news, in part, I'm sure, but also because of the changing of times, there was a huge amount of reporting using internet videos. So I thought that was interesting. So just quickly to close the France part, any sign that that was the end of the world in France, or was the reporting moderate about this?
Yes, no, that's it.
Okay.
No, I'm talking because I lived in Spain and Madrid for a couple of years. So from my experience, it almost never snows there. And if you have any snow, it snows for one day and that's it. This year, they really had loads of snow, unusual. So
okay,
that's
good.
That's the basics of my knowledge. How bad the weather is.
Okay, fine. So I guess that it wasn't a big deal. If there's something to say about this, someone raise his hand and speak.
Nice. You can see me raise my hand from Qatar.
Yeah, can see you just fine. I have Google Earth.
I'm raising my hand and nobody's even looking at me.
Turkey, stop doing this. Okay. Mohammed?
I have no comment on this.
Okay, fine. Let's move on. You don't like France, obviously. Let's shake things up a little bit. Randy, you usually go awfully long. Do you want to start us with your fascinating local stories?
I will not go along then. I will make this very brief. We're recording this. Oh, you always offend me. We are recording this episode of the Phileas Club the day before the Super Bowl in the United States, and that
Go Steelers.
That has.
Oh, do you mean to say like the most annoying and boring sport ever? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, maybe that's what he's talking about.
Yeah, I think that so, is right? Not so. What I mean to say. No, that may very well be your observation of the event. But as you well know, the National Football League Super Bowl became one of the biggest events on television in the United States and all of North America's yearly cycle a long time ago. It's been decades now that the Super Bowl is considered up there, you know, with things like the Oscars, a presidential inauguration, and so forth, and things that, you know, that people gather to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, there's so much more to it than just a football game between two American football teams. You know, there's so much news being produced about television ads and about Bruce Springsteen, who's playing at halftime, and so on and so on.
Mm.
So, you know, you could just say it's dominating right now. Of course, 24 hours after the Super Bowl, it will cease to be in any of the news. But my favorite little story is about, and I'm trying to bridge both the United States and Canada here, since I'm in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite story is about a dating service from Toronto They've called themselves the dating service for cheaters. The whole point of this company is to create a discreet online environment where people who absolutely want to hook up with other people that are in somewhat committed relationships can find one another. They literally promote adultery is what this service does. And they bought time to advertise during the Super Bowl.
They have $3 million to spend on a Super Bowl ad for telling people how to cheat.
Well, I've heard that the Super Bowl ads were really cheap this year because of the.
No! They're $3 million for 30 seconds.
Right, but you always hear a price for the most expensive time. You know what I'm saying? Like you always hear Super Bowl ad. You know, someone paid $3.5 million this year. They were buying the premier slot during a 4 or 5 hour long television production. You know, there are much cheaper times. But anyway, the point is that the story is that this service from Toronto got their time, and their ad is going to run in the United States, but it's not going to run in Canada.
What?
It makes no sense.
Wait. I don't understand. You mean the service in Canada? What do you mean? Like, what's the ad about?
Okay, there is a let's just say a website, right? A company whose dating website is specifically devoted to bringing together people who want to cheat on their spouse, basically. they are running an ad tomorrow night
that
in the
would
Super
be
Bowl.
A very popular site here.
Yeah, well, I bet they're going to make a lot of money. That's insane.
They're running an ad called "Life is Short, Have an Affair."
Okay, how is that accepted? I mean, isn't there anyone looking at these Super Bowl commercials and saying, yeah, cheating on your wife, let's put that up there?
Well, that's the point of the story, is that so far the United States television services are going with the ad, and the Canadian ones are not.
Huh. Interesting. Well, there wouldn't be any legal, you know, cheating on your wife is not illegal per se. It might put an end to it might be cause to put an end to your marriage, but you're not going to be, you know, fined or go to prison if you're cheating on your wife. It's not illegal. It's amoral in some cultures and most
unless
cultures.
You're here.
But what do you mean unless you're here?
Because here, if you cheat on your wife, you're a social pariah also, on top of committed to adultery and all those law ramifications.
Yeah.
And
I mean, in the U.S., it wouldn't be, you know, there wouldn't be any legal action. So it's interesting, though. Is it a big story now?
I would not say it's a big story. I think it'll get a little bigger in the next 24 hours. Mm. It's just fascinating that what is ostensibly a championship game between two clubs in a sport that most of the world doesn't care much for.
Yeah.
Could have grown to such a point that some little company from Toronto that's trying to make a name for itself by hooking up people that want to cheat on their spouse is able to get all of Canada talking.
Yeah.
Because, like I say, it's the Canadians that are preventing the ad from airing rather than the Americans for once.
Interesting. Another story you want to talk about?
No, I don't want to go any more long-winded.
I think I like the one-second ads.
The one-second ads, it's interesting, yeah. Do you want to... Well, it's not. It's more of about the Super Bowl.
How does a one-second ad work?
Okay, fine. Now we have to talk about it.
There's nothing to talk. We won't find out until they broadcast it on the Super Bowl.
Well, they bought 1 second ads, which is an interesting concept, and that was I can't speak anymore. That was what I was referring to when I was thinking about the cheap ads. It was the 1 second ads that the companies are buying to make their media budget cheaper. And to have, you know, people talk about it. We'll see what happens in the Super Bowl. Turkey, I think you have a couple of more serious stories, or at least one you want to talk about.
Well, let's limit it to one. So, my big problem is the Saudi religious police, or as they are officially known, the promotion of virtue and the prevention of vices authority.
The promotion of what?
Of virtue and the prevention of vices authority.
Okay. What about that?
So these are officially the religious police in Saudi Arabia. They make sure everything is running according to the Islamic law and basically their own opinion of Islamic law. So we had in a local university, a private university, Yamam University, there was an exhibition for British universities to promote their universities and to look for students to apply and to study in Britain.
Okay.
So apparently they had the event, and on the floor, on the exhibition floor, many of these universities' representatives were females. Mm-hmm. And although they were decently covered, dressed decently. Apparently, the religious police were not very happy of this, so they went into the event and they closed it down.
But what was the reason if they were dressed properly?
Well, according to them, they wanted the women to cover their hair and their faces as well.
Isn't that required anyway?
No, not exactly. It really depends on where you are. The face is a controversial thing, and the hair, they usually ignore it when they're foreigners.
Oh, sexy, sexy hair. Hair. When I see hair, it causes such impure thoughts.
Wow. Oh, that's an interesting fetish.
It's apparently one that the religious police think everyone has.
It's different though in Qatar.
So this was a huge deal. It was all over the internet. It was a huge disaster because that exhibition was partly organized by the British Embassy, and it already had the approval of the Saudi Education Ministry, and it went on in Jeddah 2 days later without a hitch, without any problems.
So was that, when things like this happen, is it controversial and people say, oh no, they're going too far? Or is it everyone rallying behind the religious police going, you know, yes, they should have?
That goes to the same point of view when I said about Gaza, how people think you're talking about the mostly educated, liberal or moderate people. Yeah, they just succeeded. However, the common people are mostly supportive of the religious police because they think they're always right.
You know, that leads me to a question about the state of Saudi Arabia in general, because you talk to us about those stories that are concerning almost every month. So I would like to ask you, is Saudi Arabia moving towards more modernity, modern society, and those are remnants of, you know, change takes time? Or is it turning back to, you know, more obscure times?
We promise we will talk about this in a specific episode, but let me put it in a most short way. Saudi Arabia has been moving into a more religious atmosphere since 1980. Since 1980, they've been moving into a more religious aspect. Modernization is here. We're a very modern country, and it's spreading very fast. There are people who are resisting modernization. There are people who insist on having these religious values on everybody. And it's a very complicated situation. It really depends on who you're talking to. There are improvements, but it's very difficult because the religious authority already have built their bases very strongly. And as I said, the common people, like the majority of people, would support the religious police, and they think they are the protectors of virtue in this country. So it's a very difficult thing because most of these people are either religious, common, low class, uneducated, or something like this. And that's the whole thing.
And by the way, I would encourage the people who are listening now and who think, wow, that's crazy, and you know, we wouldn't never do anything like that. I'm certain that even the people listening themselves, not even talking about other people in their country, would have things they considered virtuous or perverted, and they wouldn't accept the promotion of perverted behaviors and stuff like that. And also
I would like to say, you might hear all of these things about Saudi Arabia, and maybe some people would think this is bad, this is horrible, and so on. But the fact is, we have reached a level where a lot of these things that I'm talking about are actually things that are published in newspapers. 10 years ago, such news like these would never be published in newspapers. They would never be discussed in public. They are taboos. They are forbidden. We have a bit of freedom, not complete freedom for speech, but we have some freedom of speech now, better than before, and we can talk about these and discuss them, whether it's in local newspapers, on satellite TV, local TV, on internet, and everywhere. So there is some freedom at the moment when it comes to freedom of speech.
So you would say that it's going in the right direction in general still, right?
Yes, okay. It is.
And Mohammed, since we have you on the phone, what I think I perceive Qatar as a, you know, more modern Arab state. How do you view those things? Would that be acceptable in your country, or how would it be treated?
Over here, there is no religious police. Mm. Like, there's no... We allow the foreigners, since they're a large population, to go as they please. We don't force them into anything. Mm. Since the Emir of Qatar right now, since he came into power, there has been a huge modernization with him and his wife. His wife especially. She brought in Education City. We have right now Texas A&M and Georgetown and all these important colleges, thanks to her.
Right.
So... It's just for the way the only the families, the Qatari families, it's them themselves who have to teach their children how, you know, tell their children, okay, cover up. But
yeah,
usually you
so you
see
mean religion. Religion is more of a private matter. It's not statewide, you know, promoted statewide.
We have mosques and we have Islamic banks and stuff, but it's not imposed on the culture. On the expatriates.
Okay, but you won't get in trouble officially if you do something that doesn't go in accordance to the Muslim, you know, the Islamic law.
Well, we have a big church here, so you know there is, you know, we have.
Well, Patrick, it really comes down to what you call about Islamic law, because I'm sure in Qatar, kissing a man and a woman kissing in public, that would be against the law officially. So it really comes to there are limits, no matter which Islamic country, there are limits that you have to not pass. Mm, there are red lines.
So, but how do you handle it, though? Because if two foreigners are a man and a woman kiss on the street, you were saying, Mohammed, that they are not going to get in trouble.
Wait, no. Kiss as in intimate kissing or just on the cheek?
Oh, let's say they get it on and, you know, kiss on the mouth and French kiss and...
No, that's not allowed on the streets or in public.
Okay.
Because, you know, there's children and stuff and also Islamic laws.
And you don't want children to see people kissing. That would be horrible.
No,
I'm sorry, I just offended the Muslim population. I'm sorry.
No, it's just, you know, they're children. They don't really want to see that going on and stuff. They're out to have fun, not to see two people have fun.
And, you know, that might be a weird transition, but I've always found the American, how can I put it tastefully, the American way of handling female...
male relation?
No, not exactly. Okay, boobs. In America, you don't see boobs ever.
It's forbidden.
Yeah, no, but I mean, it's a really strong, I wouldn't say trauma, but at least...
it's taboo. America?
It's taboo. In the U.S., it's a taboo.
Right. You don't see boobs on commercials. You don't see breasts, bare-breasted women on TV and stuff like that. And in France, we see them all the time. If you have a commercial for, I don't know, a cream that's going to make you slimmer, then you're going to see a girl who's half naked, and she's not going to be flashing you, but it's not impossible that you're going to see her boobs.
Wait. Did you just say half naked?
It's a matter of speaking. Anyway, my point is...
And a matter of speaking for me is a bikini is half naked, but what you're talking about is more than half naked.
Well, yeah. No, I mean, the idea of seeing a woman bare-breasted is not offensive to us, is what
I mean. It's a European thing.
Right. And in the
no,
U.S.,
actually,
it would be very
I've
offensive.
Seen it in the U.S. There are, like, sometimes when I was watching Comedy Central, for example, I was watching some show late at night, and then they'd put up these commercials.
The key word being late at night.
On Comedy Central.
Yeah.
No, not on Comedy Central. They are only produce such shows on premium channels like HBO, Showtime, and so on. And
cinema. No, he was talking about commercials. Talking about
commercials. Even commercials. Commercials never.
Wait, let's ask
Randy,
the one who's actually who actually knows about this stuff.
Hey, I lived there for 6 years. Don't start.
And that's really you lived here for 6 years, and that's the thing I always would like to engage in is I would like to know what this world would be like if everyone had to go everywhere else. If every American just had to spend a little time in Saudi Arabia, and if every Iranian had to spend some time in Mexico and so forth. I think this would be a very different planet.
Randy, you put me to shame here. I'm talking about boobs and you're being grandiose. But actually, you know, that's a little bit of what we're trying to do here at the Phileas Club, right? We're trying to bring different opinions and cultures to everyone. So I think you're talking about me. Thank you. Mohammed, I don't want to skip you. What happened in Qatar this month?
This month we had the Arab Summit, January 16th. Uh-huh. We've had people from the Arab nations come as a summit. Also, the Hamas leaders and some other leaders I found on the internet. They all came in to discuss Gaza, and it's after that meeting that Qatar cut off political and economic ties with Israel.
Right. Okay. So that, yeah, you were talking about this before. Turkey, comments about this, Randy? Maybe.
I don't want to offend Muhammad.
It's okay.
Go ahead.
I'm not offended.
You're supposed to be the angry guy, so.
Yeah.
The whole summit in Qatar was a big sham. It wasn't a real summit. They never had enough people to make it an official summit by the Arab League. They didn't have the president of Palestine. They had only Hamas representing Palestine, which is Hamas is not recognized by anybody as a government. Apparently, Qatar recognizes them. And why did Qatar wait until that summit to cut ties? Why couldn't they cut ties earlier before by themselves? Did they have to wait for the summit to happen,
you know,
and insist on it happening? And the funny part is there was a summit 2 days later in Kuwait that was already organized months ago, but Qatar insisted on having their own private summit in their own kingdom.
This is something I realized, that we were trying to have the summit. We wanted more. I hate to say it, but we wanted more attention. We wanted us to have the summit. So yeah, we had two summits and not much happened.
All right. So Qatar is the kid in the Arab world trying to get more attention. Is that what we're saying? Is that our official Phileas Club position?
Okay. No offense, but the official title of Qatar by most Arab people. Especially if you go online and read about Qatar, when Qatar does something, the tiny empire of Qatar.
All right. You're making me feel like a midget with muscles or something.
Oh, no. Go ahead. You can answer that. You can answer to that. Is that? Do you feel, in Qatar, do you also feel that stigma?
No, over here in Qatar, we feel like we're actually helping. It's not a tiny empire. We feel like we have strong political power, and we're trying to help the world with it since we're so small. Like, we might as well help people politically. We can't do anything aggressively because we're so small.
And we have to say that the first real Arab news network from the Arab world came out of Qatar. So, and I honestly, I sincerely think that never, ever
talked badly about Qatar, period.
Fine. Hey, listen, that might be true. True as it is, Turkey. The fact is that when you ask someone from the outside the Arab world, maybe, I don't know how the perception is in the Arab world, but in the West, when you ask someone about the media that would be representative of the Arab world, you're going to go to Al Jazeera straight away. And that's quite an achievement.
And that's true. Al Jazeera was for some time the only Arabic news media outlet in the Arab world that would be considered independent in some way. However, that's not the fact anymore. And one proof of that is Obama talking to Al Arabiya. And now officially,
which is Qatar based.
Al Arabiya is Dubai based.
It is?
Yeah, Arabiya is
Dubai.
And it's owned by Saudis. It's a Saudi news channel owned by Saudis, broadcasting from Dubai. And Arabiya and Al Jazeera now are considered the two top Arabic news networks in the Arab world. But there are other Arab news channels as well. But these are the two top in the Arab world right now.
Okay, so I guess, you know, we can agree that... Oh, okay, go ahead.
My only source of news isn't watching the TV here. I always watch it online. So, like watching the TV here, I don't know. It's all one-sided. I usually watch it here and the computer.
Okay.
So that means Daily Show got it wrong. They said it's Qatar based.
Do you mean you get your news for, about the Arab News Network from the Daily Show?
I've watched the Daily Show. It's not. Yeah. I get my news from there. I get it from Yahoo News, CNN.
No, I'm teasing. I mean, it's very significant about, and we all know that the Daily Show has become a prime source of information in at least the United States and maybe wider. But it's
because of its humor.
I'm sorry?
It's because of its humor. It appeals to more people.
Of course.
People.
Sure, yeah.
Americans should have voted to Colbert. Colbert should have been the president of the United States of America.
I only feel bad
that they voted for Obama because now Daily Show lost its material. If it went with McCain, they would have had better material.
Better, probably, but they've been pretty good in the past few days. Okay, let's close this show. We could go on for hours. With Randy, is there anything you want to add about all this?
I really, pardon me, I really enjoyed this this one little story that came out 2-3 days ago in Singapore.
Okay.
Where a couple, a man and a woman, decided to walk around the nightclub area of the city without any clothes on. I think that it's. did you all not catch this story?
No, I would guess what happened.
The couple were described as a Caucasian man and an ethnic Chinese woman in their 20s. They proceeded to just walk around clubs and stores in the street until they were arrested and taken to jail.
They would be punished by lashes.
Well, actually, Singapore. Singapore is a pretty conservative city state, but they don't have laws that make much sense when you compare them to one another. You know, if you spit out your gum, you're going to get hit with a cane, but there's some cases where they just don't. They didn't seem to write their laws in expectation of people ever breaking them. So in this case, for example, they only really face a fine, and it's not a very large fine. I did the conversion, and it was something like $1,500 American, which is just really surprised me.
$1,500 is a lot.
Well. But compared to what could have happened to them, they could have spent 5 years in jail or and who knows what. I mean, Singapore's crazy.
They're popular with lashes in Singapore. That's why I'm surprised.
I guess, but wait, you're all hung up on the punishment. I'd like to know about the reason why they did it.
Yeah, why would they do that? I was just about to ask.
Maybe they were drinking.
Drinking? Have you They actually, I think they were attempting some sort of protest. There was mention in the stories of how in Singapore, people are trying to create an area like Speaker's Corner in London, in Hyde Park in London.
Right.
And I think these two were attempting to get some attention on that issue.
Well, but apparently they were very successful.
the funny thing is that there were so many pictures taken of them that they had all sorts of people pulling their telephones, their cell phones out and following them around, sure, taking pictures. And the quote that I came away from that story with was some blogger from Singapore who just described them and said they looked very comfortable and very happy and they were glad for the attention until they got arrested and so forth. And the quote was, he said, "Singapore is getting more and more exciting."
Well, you know, if France had more protests like these, maybe they'd get more coverage in the world news.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, people in Singapore, or at least people who protest in Singapore, know how to do it. Now I'm going to start something, you know, nude protests in France, the best of both worlds.
Please, I don't want to see you in the protest. Just pick all the nice, young, and hot girls to go on that protest.
Fine. Okay, I get it. All right. I guess that, you know what, that's going to be our end now for something completely different story, because it was pretty funny. So I guess that's going to be it. I would like to thank the three of you for coming on the show today. Turkey, you still haven't started your blog back, right? You're not going to.
Nothing in the near future. I'm really busy with life and trying to find a job, and I got a lot of things. Like, to be honest, I'm here specifically for you for the last 2 weeks. I haven't been online every day for more than an hour. I usually sit 6 to 8 hours online. The last 2 weeks, my maximum time has been an hour.
And you came just for me?
Yep.
Oh, makes me feel more.
See, even my brother was inviting me to go and have a cigar with him at the cigar lounge. I said, sorry, I have an appointment with Patrick.
Cool. I feel special. You know what? Since I feel so special, I'm going to promote your Twitter. I guess since your blog is not functional anymore, I'm going to say that you can hear a lot from Turkey and his rants on Twitter at Saudi. That's twitter.com/Saudi. Randy, you can follow Randy on Twitter at twitter.com/RandyDeluxe. Is that right, Randy?
Yes, yes, yes it is.
Anything else you want to pimp?
The Instance. For all of all of you lovers of World of Warcraft, the Instance.
Represent.
That's right.
Yeah, that's something we really can't get away from, is it? And Mohammed, do you have a Twitter account?
No, I don't really see the point.
Ah, that's because you've never tried it.
Yeah, I haven't.
Well, it's probably good for you because, you know, it would suck up a lot of your time. But thank you for coming on, Mohammed. It was a real treat. And for me, I'm just going to give you my Twitter again. It's notpatrick, so twitter.com/notpatrick. You can follow me and hear about all the crazy things happening in France. And of course, you can go to the website of the Phileas Club if you want to discuss stuff about the episode, and go to the forums and talk about what we've been discussing too. That's thephileasclub.com, P-H-I-L-E-A-S for Phileas. You can send us an email if you want to comment about the show or, I don't know, get in contact with us for anything at all at contact@thephileasclub.com. And I guess that's going to be it. We're going to talk to you again next month with wonderful stuff happening from around the world, and maybe not so wonderful too. So thanks a lot, guys, and I'll talk to all of you soon. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.